This is not the way it is supposed to be. This is one of the great truths I have heard offered in the face of a tragedy. Not an explanation, not an excuse, but simply, this is not the way it is supposed to be. It is a direct refute to the platitudes that God has a reason, that God has a plan, that God does not give you more than you can handle. These empty assurances that break down so quickly in a hospital room, in a courtroom, in an empty house. What if life unfolds abundantly and creatively and sometimes in great fragility? What if it is unpredictable and rich and fleeting? What if God does not design our pain as a way to prove God's glory? There aren't always explanations. This grinds against our scientific grounding, our quest to uncover all the facts in our intellect-driven world. But sometimes it's true. Even if we have the answers, a diagnosis or a conviction or a report, even then we may be left no closer to an explanation. How? In times like these, how can we believe? Walking down the dusty road, Jesus and his disciples come upon a blind man. The disciples are eager to put him in a box to explain why. Somebody sinned clearly, or this wouldn't have happened. Was it him? Was it his parents? Who was it? No, friends, no. Jesus shuts them down. But what follows has done plenty of damage in its own right. Jesus' words that he was born blind so that God's works might be revealed in him. Even absolved of sin, this leaves the healed man as little more than an object lesson. Biblical scholar Rolf Jacobson offers us another take. To begin with, he reminds us that the original Greek lacks verse divisions. It wasn't broken up. Those weren't added until around 1700. Jacobson suggests that this verse is better translated that neither this man nor his parents sinned. He was born blind. Period. Full stop. It just happened. And then Jesus continues. But in order that the works of God might be revealed in him, we must work the works of him who sent us while it is still day. This man was not blind so that God could look fabulous in healing him. He was just born blind. Life happened and related, but entirely separate. We are sent. We all have work to do. And it's complicated. How do we step into this work of believing, of being sent? In this story, it starts with just hearing. A stranger approaches this man on the road. He anoints him with mud, with this homemade salve earth, and tells him to go wash in the pool of Siloam. Siloam, it means sent. And the man follows before he can see Jesus, before he can see the one speaking to him. Jesus sends him to this sending, and the man is open enough to listen, to follow. There, he is healed. This is how God leads us to believe, to trust. Sight is not a magic bullet for him, though. This healed man's life does not flourish on the spot, immediately turning around. If anything, this healing sows chaos. His neighbors argue about whether they even know him. And he's hauled before the leaders as they interrogate his most basic experience. His own parents shrug in fear. The leaders cannot believe what has happened. They are closed off. It does not fit. But this man holds fast to the truth as he has received it, even as they toss him out. And then no longer begging on the street, but seeing and rejected, Jesus finds him again. He shows us that nothing, not one thing, no one is lost to God. Not this man who must beg on the street for his subsistence, invisible to those who pass him every day. God sees him. Not even when the disciples assume that he is suffering as punishment for sin. Then God finds him. Neither when he is healed and confounds the leader's rigid worldview. God returns to him, calls him open to belief. So often the story is cast as one of being lost and found, of being blind but now seeing. But the story is more than that. It's not about someone who was lost and then found, returning to life as usual. It is about transformation. It is about calling. It is a story about being found and sent. In these two encounters with Jesus, these two times of being found, this healed man teaches us what it means to believe. Johannine scholar Sunder Snyders explains that in the Gospel of John, the act of believing means holding a fundamental openness of heart. Belief is not unquestioned assent or the absence of doubt. She explains it instead as the basic readiness to see and hear what is really there, the fidelity to one's own experience, no matter how frightening or costly it appears to be. This healed man does the work of God by showing us how to live with a profoundly open heart to God's unfolding truth. This man is open. He listens. He responds. He is ready to learn, asking, "Who is this Son of Man? Tell me, tell me." And he's also paying attention to his experience, trusting what he has lived in his body, even if he can't explain it. When he finds the truth of that abundant life, no matter the attacks that accompany it, he is unwilling to let it go. He refuses to be bound again. His belief is expressed as a commitment to being open. This past week, I spent time in conversation with my friend John, wondering together about a call he had received, an invitation that left him puzzling. He'd been asked to be a godparent. John is a tender and humble human being. He's gentle. He's the kind of person that you want to have at your side in a tense situation, but not because he's, you know, the big bouncer type. And so it was with some amusement that he recounted why these parents had asked him to be their child's godfather. They said they wanted their son to grow up with the love and example of a strong man. Me? A strong man? It was confusing at first. It didn't seem to match his social position or his self-expression. He wanted to make sense of what this commitment would mean here and now. In large part, John was wrestling with this question because growing up in his family, it seemed that the role of godparents was mostly an honorary one. It was about paying them respect, celebrating them at the baptism. And that may have been fun, but it did not give way to a deeper relationship in the years that followed. John wondered, vulnerably, what he might have to offer this child. He lacked a compelling model for how the relationship could grow faithfully. Thinking back on his own childhood, he remembered receiving the glowing attention of adults when he performed well. For example, when he excelled in school. But that this actually felt isolating. It was contingent on his external success. There wasn't space for him to live fully as himself, to be open, to be out. Eventually, it seemed that there wasn't really room for him in the church either. And so how could he do this now? How do we offer a gift that we have not received? As John sat with it, though, he came to hear the truth in his friend's words. They saw his strength in the resilience, in the healing, the leading work that he had been living out for years. They respected the compassion that he brought to his work in the world. And more recently, they admired his commitment to finding a reconciling way back into this body. They recognized the presence of transformation in John and called him to live that out in a new way. As we talked, I heard him give witness to his truth. It was not that he had been blind and now could see. Rather, he had been left apart and now is home. He has been found and seen and has heard the call to love more deeply. As I sat with our conversation in the days since, what I've carried with me was John's tremendously open heart. He is open to hearing new truth, open to being surprised by his experience of healing. He is open to encountering the holy, even in unbidden, unexpected ways. He's asking big questions and is ready to be called, ready to be sent. In his open searching, John reminded me that this is how we believe. It is the act of trusting that we are never too lost to be found again, and then opening our hearts to be sent.